This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
I'm gonna marry the night. I won't give up on my life. I'm a warrior queen, live passionately.
You're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9. Broad would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands that we broadcast from, the Kulin Nation, and pay respect to all the Kulin women elders from the past, present, and those women who will be the future elders. We'd also like to acknowledge with respect the traditional owners of all the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander land that we broadcast to, and pay respect to all our women elders from all clans and nations, past, present, and future. Welcome to Broad, Monday the 27th of March 2017. I'm Jane Connery, and a big shout out to our regular host, Sonia, who'll be back on Broad very soon. John's back again this week, keeping me company and keeping this show on the air. Hey, John.
Hey,
Jane. We've just heard Rihanna with Shine Like a Diamond. A bit of a clue as to the first guest on Broad tonight, where we'll continue to talk about female-centric topics from a feminist and inclusive perspective. But later on tonight, we have an amazing interview with Nancy Bejaya, Managing Director of the HM Group, an award-winning creative studio producing relevant high-end design since 1996. And I'll also be chatting with Bonnie Abbott on my Broad Design segment, where we give voice and visibility to women in the creative industries. Bonnie is a strategic designer, writer and researcher who held a workshop on the weekend during Design Week called The Designers in the Detail. I was lucky enough to join in on the event, so we have lots to talk about tonight with Bonnie, including discussions on detail and participatory design. But first up on Joy 94.9 tonight is my first guest, who is, among other things, a jeweller. There's the link to Rihanna and her diamonds, people. Anyway, on the Art Jewellery Forum last month, Meredith Turnbull, academic sculptor and visual artist, posted an article titled Punk Jewellery, Infiltration and Parasitism. I'm not even sure I'm saying that right. The article starts, there's a new genre of contemporary jewellery emerging in Melbourne. On the surface, it appears connected through a shared aesthetic temperament. However, what more concretely defines this movement is a collective concern with new forms of social and cultural mediation and a sense of irreverence. Meredith is here to talk more about this discovery tonight and to discuss work by Debris Facility and Rebecca Thomas, whose work is a great example of this irreverence and inspired amateurism that she writes about. Welcome to the show, Meredith.
Thanks, Jane.
Meredith, I'm a Melbourne-born and bred Gen Xer. And I've always felt like I grew up in a generation when the cultural phenomenon of the time was pretty dull. Grunge and its slacker mentality had no impetus to stick it to the man. But to know there's a new punk movement starting in Melbourne made me a little bit excited. Now, your article is subtitled Infiltration and Parasitism. Can you explain what you mean by this and how does this play out in jewellery design on our bodies?
I guess primarily it's about combining different approaches to making. Yep. So that might, whether that you work across a variety of media or work across a variety of disciplines, and by this by kind of utilizing this combination, you can push the work in different ways. So, and parasitism is generated from Debris Facilities art practice, specifically looking at the way that they might piggyback jewellery onto sculptural intervention, or how they might integrate different ideas of media into the one artwork.
Mm-hmm. Was I reading something about Debris' work where it became a soap dispenser?
That was for the Tarawarra Biennale.
Okay.
And they collaborated with Rebecca Thomas, actually, on the design of the soap holders.
Yep.
But they also made soap dispensers. And so it was an artwork that used activated soap.
Yep.
But it was available in the toilets of the gallery museum. Yeah.
So it was kind of infiltrating the space as an object as well as an idea.
Yeah, as a functional object. Mm.
This style of jewellery we're discussing tonight has been critiqued as calculated sloppiness. Explain how the work might be interpreted this way, or even what a piece might look like as a sort of piece of punk jewellery.
So calculated sloppiness was a term that Glenn Adamson noted, but it's also, I think, sort of devolved into popular vernacular to sloppy craft, which is kind of a pejorative term, I feel. I don't necessarily identify with the term sloppy craft because I think it's often used to denigrate a type of craft practice that is perhaps a little bit more amateur in its visual appearance.
Yep.
But I guess what I was interested in positing was that it's not these group of artists, Clementine Edwards included with Debris Facility and Rebecca Thomas, shouldn't necessarily be defined by that kind of terminology, and they're doing their own thing. And it's very much, I think, related to punk and DIY more so than sloppy craft.
Yep. So punk sought to reject or provide alternatives to the political and cultural status quo of the UK and the US in the 70s. How is this jewellery responding to the cultural and political environment in Melbourne right now?
I think it's actually doing very similar things, because with the artists that I've been observing, it's not just the three that I mentioned in the article, but a broader kind of community of artists working around this sort of area, is that they're very politically engaged. Mm. And I think they just respond to the inherent conservatism of the Australian politics of our time.
Yep.
And they also reject, I guess, or try and provide alternatives, to not only political alternatives, but ways of working with art practice as well.
Yeah. So tell me a bit more about Debris Facility's work, sort of the performative and sculptural nature, as well as the wearability of the jewellery.
So Debris Facility, they describe their work as a generative apparatus, which I think is a really good way of explaining it, that in fact it's kind of like a methodology or a making strategy, and it's a strategy that incorporates or that's looking, what they suggest is that it's looking to slice through intersections of sculptural installation, performance, video and wearable works. So it's looking at where these disciplines might intersect, but also like pushing those limits as well.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff.
I think so.
I mean, there are things like bracelets and bangles. I've had a look around at the work.
Yeah, I think also what's interesting about their practice is for a long time they had made jewellery work, and it's become increasingly more incorporated into the practice overall. And in fact, it is a way of remunerating the practice or sustaining the practice financially.
Mm.
But it becomes kind of wrapped up in this bigger trajectory.
Yeah, I love the ideas behind it. Here at Broad, we look at issues through a feminist lens. You mentioned Claude Cahoon and Rebecca Thomas's brooch for Claude in the article. What parallels between punk and feminism do you see in her work and the work in a broader sense?
Well, I think there's a definite aesthetic connection to punk in the fact that it looks quite dangerous,
yep,
and difficult to wear, and that it might injure you. But it's also related, I guess, to mourning jewellery, or how jewellery can be sentimental, because it is memorialising Claude Cahoon's work and significantly her practice too. I mean, I can't speak for how Rebecca would specifically relate to Claude Cahoon, but I can say for myself, the way I interpret it is that, you know, Claude Cahoon was one of the first female photographers to really be looking at the self, and self-portraiture, and particularly trying to reflect or break up how the kind of social norm of how we might convey gender and sexuality.
Mm.
And she her work is very evocative, and it's really emotional and moving as well. And I think, you know, it is sort of like a memorial to her as a feminist art icon.
And the works, those photographs that she used, look quite contemporary. If you're not sort of sure of the context, they could have been taken
They could be taken today. Mm. They're really quite amazing works, and they were shot in the late 1920s. Mm. So they're, you know, they're from that period.
Yeah, yeah. That whole history of kind of gender bending, basically, being explored through jury, I find that really, really interesting.
Yeah, and also Claude was a political activist too. She was involved in the French Resistance. Mm. She was imprisoned at one stage, sentenced to death. She wasn't actually, she wasn't put to death, but, you know, the effects of this, she was very involved in the resistance during the World War II and the kind of effects of war and the displacement of artists and other peoples during that time. Yeah,
it's amazing how jewelry become a historical kind of teaching resource as well.
Absolutely, it can. But I think what's significant about all of these artists' works is that although they engage with these ideas, they also leave it very much open to the wearer and to the viewer to bring their own meaning to the work as well. Mm. And that's one of the things that's really engaging about their practices.
You mentioned mourning jewelry. Can you explain a bit what the history of that?
Well, it's different in different cultures. But I guess it's more linked to Victorian mourning jewellery in relation to Rebecca's work.
Yeah, yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for your time tonight, Meredith. It's been fantastic to have you.
Thanks, Jane.
My pleasure. This really isn't nappy pins, tartan and razor blades, but the way you are challenging gender norms and traditional concepts by looking at this jewellery is very punk. I've posted links to Meredith's punk jewelry article on the Broad Facebook page, where you can also see some of Debris and Rebecca's work. Keep your eye out for links to our podcasts there as well. We'll be back soon after some announcements and a little bit of feminist punk from L7 with Pretend You're Dead. This is Broad on Joy 94.9.
A diverse sound for a diverse crowd. Joy 94.9.
Hi, this is Scarlett and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
Welcome back. You're on Joy 94.9 and you're listening to Broad with me, Jane Connery. You may have noticed this slight obsession I have with design during my time on Broad. Well, it will keep going, I promise. I dabble in graphic design myself. I've been teaching design for over 10 years and I'm currently doing my PhD exploring the visibility of women in Australian design. Talking to women about design is what I do best, so let's keep that going with my next guest. Bunny Abbott describes herself on her LinkedIn profile as a design strategist with a special interest in ethnographic research and its actionable interpretation. She was the editor of Australia's oldest design magazine, Desktop, from 2013 to 2015, and now runs Double Days with Amy Jay, where they've put together the gorgeous publication Gather and Fold about designers and their process. I got to hang out with Bonnie on the weekend and partake in her workshop called The Designers in the Detail, which was a great way to spend a Saturday during Design Week. Welcome to Broad, Bonnie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
My pleasure. First things first, Bonnie, ethnographic research and actionable interpretation is a bit of a mouthful.
It is.
Tell me what this means to those who aren't designers.
Well, ethnographic research is a research method typically seen in anthropology. It's a way of writing, understanding cultures.
Yep.
And it's really useful in design, and it's becoming more and more prevalent because, well, design, it produces cultural objects. Mm. And, well, it aims to. Don't always stick. So it's a really effective method for trying to understand spaces that design products are going to be entering, mm-hmm. By understanding the cultures that they want to exist in and be successful within. So the actionable interpretation, yes, is really key. Most researchers learn about ethnography.
Yep.
But actually forming that or doing interpretations that can be related to design processes is quite tricky. Mm. If you're not a designer. So the actionable part is really key, and it's what I'm trying to focus on at the moment.
Yeah, I see it very tied into the whole human-centered design sort of methodologies. It's about people.
Yeah, it is. And it can be about understanding people as individuals, but also understanding the groups that they belong to and the behaviours of those groups.
Yep, yep. We'll be back after these messages and we'll continue our chat with Bonnie on Broad Joy 94.9.
I'm Bryony Kidd and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
Hi, we're back on Broad. We've just had a SMS come through which says, awesome song. Yes, I love This Is a Teen. Great show, guys. From Beck. That must have been about L7. That was kind of something I loved as a teen too. Bonnie, you've spent a slice of your career in publishing and magazines. Designers have waxed lyrical about whether print is dead. But it appears niche magazines like Frankie are increasing circulation while the big players are losing sales. What's your thoughts on these new business models and digital media in publishing?
So I have published as a self-publisher and then also when I was editor of Desktop as well. And they were very different experiences because I went into self-publishing with absolutely no plan to make money. So there was no disappointment there.
Yes.
And then when you head up a magazine like Desktop, which has unfortunately closed this year after 30 years of being in print.
I had an interview in the final edition. I'm so proud.
Oh, good. They faced huge challenges. Mm. And the biggest problem is print magazines just trying to exist as they always were, but just in a digital form.
Mm.
And that, you know, I can't say what's going to work in digital publishing, yeah. but just that direct translation was never going to work. The way that we consume content is so different now.
Mm.
Mm. So the people that I know now that are involved in self-publishing, they'll also be the first people to tell you that they're not doing it to make money. It's often you know, a reflective practice that they do or a critical practice. They're kind of exploring themes through publishing. It's not about really about news or, you know, up-to-date affairs. It's really just exploring things in quite a personal way.
Yeah, personal projects.
Yeah.
And designers do.
I don't know how, you know, big magazines are still going.
Yeah.
The challenges are immense, yeah.
They are. So your workshop, Designers in the Details, was great. The event was designed to investigate who we are as people and as designers, how that impacts our recognition of valuable insights and how we utilise them to solve design problems. I came home with my little sort of diagram of what I think Details was and how that became a creative process. Oh, we did one exercise and by the end of it you said, there's your framework. And I'm like, oh, we just did it.
Yeah.
That was a nice kind of, I didn't realise I was doing it. Anyway, trying to define what detail means to me and how my creative process can be constructed in a framework was an adventure. The crew that attended the workshop had some great questions for you that you struggled with at the time. So I thought I'd ask you them again. And one of them was, how do you define detail?
I did struggle with that at the time and I knew you were going to ask me this question and I thought about it and I still really can't answer that straight. Mm. You really need to kind of qualify what that detail is. And so if you ask me, you know, what does a good detail look like, even then I think I would struggle because, you know, the follow-up question would be, well, you know, why do you need it? Where are you in a design project that you, you know, require a detail? But it's, you know, what the class was telling me on Saturday is that, you know, details have all forms.
Yes.
Depending where you are and what you need. But it's, you know, they can be things that really inspire you to ask more. That's always something that I'm really interested in is that someone says something that just sounds so profound that is so everyday to them. That's often a really good detail.
There was a lovely mix in the room at the workshop. You had architects, service designers, educators, students.
Yeah, so there was a bunch of people saying, well, details to me are those really technical requirements of a project. And yeah, absolutely, they are. And to other people, they were things that you uncover during research that, you know, can help drive a project and give it relevance and give it importance. Mm. And, you know, for me, if I'm doing research, it's the things that are meaningful to people that, you know, can't be forgotten or can't be lost along the road. So, yeah, it's hugely different for all types of designers and all different stages. And so really acknowledging that and keep like documenting around it is hugely important to practice.
So we still don't know.
Still don't know.
And someone else asked, what piece of work are you most proud of? Have you thought about that now?
I think I'll stick. I mean, that was a really good question.
Yeah.
And also another one I wasn't expecting. But I'll stick with my original answer, which was with writing a course. And I mean, it's an action of design. You're designing a course in the way that information is going to be taken in by other people. And it was a level of detail that I had never worked at.
What do you call the course?
Design and Fidelity. Yeah. I teach that at RMIT. And it's also the basis of where these workshops come from as well. And yes, it's a synthesis of knowledge and research that to a depth that I've never worked at before. So that was probably my most challenging project.
Great, great. I've been doing a bit more cyber stalking on you. There's a lot on the internet, Bonnie, probably the most I've come across.
Have
on
to do a
guess.
Cleanse.
And I came across the awesome website Designers Who. Tell us a bit more about that website and how it works and who's it for. And when I was sort of trawling through it, I'll give you time to answer that question.
Okay.
I came across an article about can design be genderless? So I'd love to talk about that as well. But tell me how Designers Who works.
Also, that's a Double Days project, which is a personal studio that I run with my friend Amy J, where we just explore things that are interesting to us. And we started Designers Who a little while ago when we were interested in different ways to publish design commentary. So all of the articles are off-site. They're not written by us, but we just kind of publish a link to them and then only actually have on the site the commentary from people who have read the article. So it's kind of like a book club in a way.
And it
just was an experiment in, you know, whether that could actually work as a place that people wanted to go to talk about and consume design.
I think it's a thing that's needed in Australian design because there's not a lot of that critical discourse. It's lovely that you created a platform for that to happen.
It is, but I think it was an experiment at the time. But, you know, I don't know how relevant it really is now. I think people share content like that in quite a personal way. You share them between friends and colleagues. And I don't know how much you go to a central place anymore to have kind of curated content. So it really was an experiment and it had a kind of a certain reaction. So we did two seasons, we called them seasons, of articles. And then, so it just kind of sits there at the moment as an archive. But yeah, the Designers Genderless article is one of the articles that we used for people to kind of talk about.
Do you think design needs to be genderless, or that is a question? Is it,
it's a provocative title that they used. So it relates to a talk that was on at the Design Museum for a while ago, a couple of years ago, that someone wrote up an article about. And they were posing the question, it was a provocative question around why is gender an actual thing in design? Like, why does it need to be a thing? Which is a really broad question across society at the moment.
Yes.
Why does gender have to be as big a thing as it is? And, you know, we talked earlier about design being cultural and that quite often we're reflecting what culture is. So that's why we still have tampon boxes that are pink with flowers on them. And that's what some students are still taught to do.
Yes, shrink it and pink it.
Really? Is that a thing?
Yeah, I've heard it.
Yeah, so nice, small, neat kind of ideas around what's feminine.
Yes, yeah, traditional sort of, even though that history of making things smaller and pink, it doesn't go that far back in history, but it's part of that sort of cultural thing now.
Yeah.
There is a bit of a backlash against it. I think Target stopped having a girls and a boys toy aisle recently because that's what it was doing, basically.
Yeah, it's interesting because, design is reflecting those values of society, but it has such a power to be an agent of change. Mm. And that's what they were talking about in that particular article, is that, you know, if you're a designer, what's something you can do today, even in just 10 minutes, that can really challenge that idea? Because you can, being something that is adding and talking about culture and society, you do have that power to make a small statement. So something they suggested is, you know, in your office, if you have a toilet that is male and a toilet that is female, why do they have to be like that? Surely everyone just uses both anyway.
Yeah, well, at home, so no why one has do a boys they, and
yes,
girls toilet,
absolutely.
Do they?
So why does that actually need to be there?
Yep, yep. One last question. I'm really interested about your journey into design, and I know that was another tricky question for you. And I'm always impressed by the history of your education, where you've studied overseas, how you went to New York. I'm trying to follow in your footsteps there. Yep. Tell me about that journey to becoming a designer.
So my family moved to the UK, so it wasn't a purposeful thing to get educated overseas, but that's how it worked out. But I got a really interesting education. My degree had a real focus on not the application of design so much, but the thinking of design. They were really proud of their design thinkers.
Yep.
This is before that was
a thing.
And then being able to do the master's in London, which was under, I don't think you'll ever hear this, but under quite an odd man, called Jeff Crook, who really tried to challenge the way that design was taught and the way that we interact with other disciplines. So it was a really interesting course that really confused me at the time, but has continued to play out in the way that I do challenge the way that I work with other people and how they all work together.
Yeah.
And then that course in New York, so you're talking about DCRIT,
yes.
Which is a summer residency held at the School of Visual Arts in New York.
Yes.
And it's run by Steve Heller, mm-hmm. who, if anyone doesn't know, is a famous design historian and author.
Writer.
Yeah.
I think it's
120 books, I think it is. Yeah. And he's, quite an established voice. And it's an excellent course that really explores the way that we write about, talk about, and critique design. And the output of that is writing, but the research side of it and the way that we understand it is wonderful and has been really formative to the way I think and practice design as well.
Great. It's nice to know about your journey. Well, Bunny, that's all we've got time for tonight. Thank you so much for dropping by and sharing your passion for design with us. And drilling into the details, which is what it's all about. I've posted links to Double Days on the Broad Facebook page where
Thanks.
A podcast of our conversation will also appear. We'll be back after the messages with our chat with Nancy. You're on Broad on Joy 94.9.
A diverse sound for a diverse crowd. Joy 94.9.
I am Sophie Hyde and you're listening to Broad on Joy 94.9.
We're back, and that was a little bit of Dirty Minds from Shakespeare's Sister, and this is Broad on Joy 94.9. My next guest has been running the creative business HM since 1996, but is also an AGDA board member, mum, and all-round impressive human being.
Thank you.
Welcome to Broad, Nancy Vijaya. I create, I grow, I inspire, I engage, I love. HM has a beautiful mission statement in these five sentences. Can you explain to us the work that HM is doing right now and how this aligns with these values?
So our role to our clients is really both, I guess, leading and supportive. We produce anything from artistic ad campaigns to branding. We're producing we're rolling out a massive rebrand at the moment. Each component of our process really aligns with these beautiful words. We treat every task or project as an opportunity. We really get in really, with a really firm understanding of what we're dealing with to ensure that we treat each opportunity appropriately, whether it's a creative opportunity versus a templated piece that requires consistency. Each are kind of as just as important as one another. I really love what we do, and I think it comes through to all of our work and directly from the leadership.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a great design studio, a team of 9 core employees and a fabulous client list. You got it all. And you grew up in Sunshine in the 70s. Yay to all us Western Suburbs girls. I'm a Werribee girl. What were your experiences like growing up in the West, and where did you get your creative aspirations from?
Well, to clarify, the burb was Ardia.
Okay.
Yep, my parents still live there. I still hang out there a lot. So
nice.
Very grateful for my upbringing, actually. It was very similar to my own children's, you know, the great sense of community, the supportiveness, really great experiences at school, teachers to remember. Grateful for that, proud of my parents who are Maltese immigrants who kind of came here with nothing and taught me resilience and independence, and I think that's helped me become who I am today. And I think I was born creative. I really do believe I was. And it was, my creativity was mostly supported. I say mostly because I was encouraged to draw and, you know, I was a creative thinker from a very young age, but I guess I really found it most difficult when it came to entering higher education. Mm. That's when, I guess, where I came from had an impact, unfortunately. Yep. But, yeah, it didn't stop me. It certainly didn't. And I, you know, remain really true and humble to my roots and, yeah, as I said, very proud of where I've come from.
Yep, yep. So you studied at Barton, is that right? I got that right?
Yes. It doesn't exist anymore, does it?
No, well, it got merged. A lot of TAFEs got merged a while ago. What were experiences like studying at TAFE and sort of knowing that that's your qual and that now that you own your own studio, how relevant were those qualifications starting out as a graphic designer in the 90s when there was a recession? How did that all sort of work?
Well, I'll start with the education experience at Barton was one to remember, really. I was trained by typographers and artists and photographers and got to really learn and understand the fundamental of art and design. You know, computer design was a tiny component, like half an hour of a week.
How funny. Was it a green screen?
Yeah.
Totally. We're the same age. That's what it was like for me.
And it really was such an insignificant component. So that's why the education was fantastic. And I think that those kinds of fundamentals are really important when it comes to growing as a designer. I feel that the relevance and my qualifications didn't really matter when I finished because of that time. It was a recession. There was no work. So, and as you would know, in our industry, it's so rapid. So qualifications during that course, it was really about the, I guess, artistic design fundamentals that stuck with me. But in terms of the rest, I'm very self-taught. Mm. And, you know, starting my own business soon after that course.
That was HM? That was your first business?
It was.
And it's still going.
I know.
HM stands for House Mouse. You've got to tell us how you came up with that name.
All right. It's really embarrassing, but I will tell you and your listeners. Miguel and I started House Mouse for the sake of being different. So we wanted a name that was different. But how we came up with that name was due to a real rodent that was in my family home at the time. And my baby sister got out her animal encyclopedia and looked up what are these mice called that invade our homes. And it was the house mouse. And I remember, you know, picking up the landline and calling Miguel's number going, I've got the name, House Mouse. And it really stuck and it worked really well for us for so many years. And it wasn't until only 3 years ago that we changed our name.
Yes.
We found that we weren't cute anymore. You know, House Mouse was so cute. It was the two of us. We grew up and it didn't suit us and we needed to, I guess, practice what we preach about design and branding and reposition ourselves and our individual, our kind of look and feel to represent who we were, and that was HM.
Yes.
And that's who we are now.
And so you moved studios as well. You had a fabulous article in The Age when you moved office space late last year, I think it was. Tell me about that transformation and how effective you think open plan office life is for a team of creatives.
It's imperative, definitely, in my business. I'm all about collaboration. We talk so much, our team, which is great. I really enjoy that. It allows us to be creative in every aspect, you know, right down to when we're discussing food. It's what that open plan format does also is makes me accessible as the managing director. It makes Miguel accessible as the creative director. In fact, everyone in the studio is accessible to one another. We each know our boundaries. Often I would, you know, shout out that I'm just a, this is virtual reality. Nancy's not really here today, so no one talked to me. It's imperative.
And it makes it easy to drop by on a Friday and pinch a glass of wine, I found out too.
Yes, how good was that?
And just quickly, you have a role in AGDA at the moment, the Australian Graphic Design Association, and you're mentoring women. What's the best way to help establish a design career and maintain longevity as a woman in design?
Well, I think it really is ensuring that as a woman in design, well, as any designer, you network, you know, form a community, gather with other designers. AGD is a really fantastic organisation that allows access for that. And, of course, AGDA has an amazing mentorship program that any woman or designer could apply for, if you remember, and have access to people like me and other amazing women and men who are willing to mentor.
I've put links to HM on our broad Facebook page, but I'll have to put the AGDA link up there too.
Please do.
So if people
Thank you.
Haven't figured out what AGDA does, that's a great place to start. But we are done. Thank you so much, Nancy,
Thanks
for coming
for
by
me.
Tonight. What a great show. We couldn't have had it happen without your help, John. Thank you for being my friend.
You're very welcome.
Thank you to all my guests and for sharing their creative endeavours as creative human beings on Broad, Meredith Turnbull, Bonnie Abbott and Nancy Bajaya. Stay with us because up next is Beck with Bite Me Down Under. Can't wait to hear what this week's throwback track is. This has been Broad on Joy 94.9 and I'm Jane Connery.
A little less straight than other radio stations. Joy 94.9. Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.